Hey everyone, it's me, W. Kamau Bell. If you haven't heard the news, well, this news, I'm the 2025 official host of the ACLU's podcast At Liberty. Whoop, whoop. Every episode, I'll be asking the big questions on the big issues affecting our country, and we know there's lots of big issues, and especially those issues happening to some of our hardest hit and most vulnerable communities. And I'm calling on ACLU experts, or as I'm calling them, the WKB ACLU Special Correspondents Task Force. That is the WKB ACLU SCTF. They are here to answer those questions. For our first episode of the year, I sat down with the ACLU's legal director, Cecilia Wong, to discuss the Trump administration's first days in office and the first wave of executive orders that followed. Go ahead and check out that episode after you listen to this one. And make sure that you're subscribed to At Liberty so you don't miss a single conversation. They're all good. They're all necessary. We're here together. Today, we're focusing on one of our most critical frontiers for civil liberties, LGBTQIA plus rights. See, we keep all the letters in there. And specifically, transgender rights. On his first day in office, President Trump signed an executive order requiring federal agencies to discriminate against transgender people by denying who they are. The Trump administration is also attempting to shut down access to necessary medical care for transgender people under the age of 19 nationwide. One of the first actions that the House took in 2025 was to order the State Department to stop granting requests for new or updated passports with gender markers that don't conform with the new definitions of sex, in quotes, as laid out by President Trump's executive order. And we're recording this on Friday, February 7th, not even 3 weeks into Trump's term. We know that LGBTQ plus people aren't going anywhere. But can the federal government really scrub their rights as quickly as they can scrub DEI mentions on a website? It's an uncertain, confusing time. But I know just the trusted ACLU expert to help us out. All right, get settled. Take a deep breath. Find your center. Let's go. Today's guest is Chase Strangio, co-director of the ACLU's LGBT and HIV project, as well as a nationally recognized expert on transgender rights. His work includes impact litigation as well as legislative and administrative advocacy on behalf of LGBTQ people and people living with HIV across the United States. And in December 2024, he became the nation's first openly trans person to argue in front of the Supreme Court in U.S. versus Scrimeti. He doesn't know it yet, but I'm also recruiting him to my WKB task force, so hopefully you'll be hearing a lot more from him this year. Please welcome to the show, Chase Strangio! Hey, Chase.
Hey, how's it going?
That's what I wanted to start. I wanted to act like we're just two old friends who haven't talked in a while, which you were on my old podcast, Politically Reactive, and that was many years ago. Yeah, I'm glad you do. I know you have a lot going on, but I just want to ask the most complicated question to ask. How are you doing?
You know, that is complicated, but I'm holding up okay. I am happy to be alive, be in community with people, take in it one day at a time, and reminding myself to breathe. How are you doing?
The same. Like, I'm just like, you know, like I just was talking to my 6-year-old daughter. My wife and her dropped me off here for this podcast recording, and my daughter was like, why do you work every day now? You didn't used to work every day, which I think a little bit. I did always work every day, but her perception is changing. But I was like, because Trump's in office now, I have more work to do. Like, you know, so I think it's just recognizing that, like, I have to show up more. And I'm lucky that I can do things like this, like talk to you and work with the ACLU. But also, you know, it does mean that there's less time for the fun things in life, like hanging out with your daughter who is drawing doodles in her notebook.
That's real. That's very real. So we got to remember to keep doing those fun things too, because that's how we're going to have the endurance to fight everything we got to fight.
Yeah. I was saying before we started, because you were answering an email and I was sort of joking about the fact that you needed to pay attention to me. And I was joking because I just want to be clear. As I said before we started, interviewing you is a little bit like I feel like interviewing Batman. You might just have to go like fight the Joker. And if an email comes in that says it's time for Chase to go fight the Joker, you just go. OK, I just want to be clear.
I'm out of here. You know, you know, the signal might come and I will have to depart from here into Gotham.
you're doing all this incredible work. I'm sure there's a million things going on. Is there something that's top of mind right now for you that is like, this is the thing that I'm thinking about when I'm not thinking about all the other things?
Oh, that's a great question. I think the reality is when I'm not thinking about each individual thing, that it's actually the big picture that's haunting me, that the reality of an administration that is so aggressively using the power of the government to target groups that have historically been oppressed and doing so for the sake of building power. And in such a sort of mean-spirited but transparently maniacal way. And that just keeps me up at night. And when I think about my community, I think about the trans community, it's the magnitude of assaults and then also rhetorically what that is sending the message of, both to trans people and to those watching. So that's really what I'm sort of sitting with. That what does it mean to be a sort of people under assault, and how do we fight back?
Yeah, I think that, you know, and that's the way it seems to be with all the issues. They seem to be operating at these sort of like big institutional levels, but then also levels that seem petty but aren't petty, like even things like, and I would love to hear your thoughts on this, like changing the LGBTQ to LGB and that's it, and like, you know, like that seems on some level it seems super petty, but it's also super clear what they're trying to do there, but just changing it at all things at all levels.
Yeah, it's like you see an administration that is like, we're going to try to literally delete your existence from the government websites while we're implementing government policies that are trying to make survival for so many people impossible. So yeah, it's like the petty things also take on such a magnitude when you combine it with the material consequences of the policies that this government is putting forth.
So can you just, for our sake, remind our listeners what gender-affirming care means and what it is, and why, and I'm going to add this part to it, and why it's not the scary thing that the right would lead you to believe it is.
Yeah, so gender-affirming medical care is the provision of medical care for transgender people supported by doctors and patients, and in the case of minors, their parents, that allows transgender people to live consistent with their gender identity. And all gender-affirming care is medication or other medical care that non-transgender people also receive. And so what it might look like is hormones, estrogen or testosterone, so that a trans person can live and express themselves consistent with their male or female identity. And the reality is that the first of all, number one consumers of gender-affirming medical care are non-transgender people, that most gender-affirming medical care are things that, you know, that cis people get to, you know, remove facial hair for women. And this is very common, and we recognize it as permissible. And yet what we've seen in the last 4 years in particular is this fundamental assault on the entire medical establishment's supported treatment paradigm for transgender people, acting as though there is a conspiracy to inject people with this, you know, wildly harmful series of medications. But the reality is that these are longstanding medications that have been used for transgender people and non-transgender people alike. And what we have now is this escalation of assaults from the state governments criminalizing and banning this care to now the federal government doing the same thing. And this should concern people, I think, for sort of two fundamental reasons. And the first is that if the government can come in and declare that a group of people can't access the medical care they need because they are politically unpopular, then it's just simply not going to stop with transgender people. Mm-hmm. And our gender-affirming medical care is doctor-supported, evidence-based medical care, just like many other forms of medical care. It is not somehow uniquely vulnerable to being justifiably banned by the government. And then the second thing, particularly with the Trump administration, that I really want people to be keyed into is this is yet another power grab from the Trump administration, where the president is trying to put himself above all other branches of government and above the Constitution so that he can proclaim national policy to harm the people he doesn't like. And so if trans people's medical care, our gender-affirming medical care, can be under assault, there's nothing stopping your care from being next.
Mm-hmm. And when you say your care, I hear that specifically as me and my identity as a black man, that I know that, like, if the, all this stuff ends up coming for black folks. Like, so I think it's a reason why, and I, when I say black folks, certainly there are black trans people, but I mean, like, cisgender, heterosexual black folks are always going to be on the next in line for whatever awful thing this government is doing, especially black women in this country who already suffer horrible health outcomes just by nature of the fact this country is always targeting black women. So I think that that can't be said enough, that, like, all this stuff, there's not like, oh, now that we've taken care of this community, we're going to stop being awful. That's not how it goes.
Right. And of course, as you know, that there are so many people who exist at the intersection of so many systematic assaults from the state and federal governments. If you're a trans immigrant, if you're a black trans person, then that means these systems of racism, these systems of colonial control, and then transphobia are making life quite literally impossible right now. And we have to be in a position to say we can't let people be subjected to this kind of systematic government attack.
Can we talk about the executive orders that are sort of related to or targeting the LGBTQ IA plus rights?
Oh my God, I know. Is it three weeks or 3 years or three
exactly.
centuries?
Yeah, yeah.
It's like 3 weeks. That can't be right.
I know.
I feel like that's not right. But with these executive orders, it feels like one catastrophic executive order targeting the trans community every single day. I think there's been about 10. And so, you know, if that's about, you know, one every other day. And these range from this sweeping executive order that came down on Inauguration Day on January 20th, in essence, announcing that it is the policy of the federal government to not recognize that transgender people exist, and then directing agencies across government to start to implement policies excising trans people literally from the government websites, from the restrooms, but then also from legal protections across the government. So that was day one. And then from there, there have been a series of other orders targeting, you know, excluding trans people from the military. And as we know, the President Trump did enact a military ban on openly trans service members in his first administration. But what is very noticeable here is that there's an escalation in terms of the breadth of these orders and the rhetoric. Here with the military service ban, President Trump is announcing that to be an openly trans person is to live a lie that is not consistent with honor. And so saying that we are incompatible with things like military service, and when the military is the largest employer in the United States, that is a huge material impact on a group that's already underemployed and disproportionately represented in the military. And then there was an executive order seeking to nationally ban gender-affirming medical care for transgender people under the age of 19. So that's not just minors, but also 18-year-olds who are legal adults. And executive order that was called Banning Radical Indoctrination in Schools, targeting the discussion of the history of racism in the United States and the existence of transgender people together. And that has sweeping effects, threatening federal funding. This is a big thing that the administration is doing, is using the power of the federal government to threaten states and other local entities that do things they don't like. And so with the medical care executive order, with the school's executive order, in essence, the administration is saying, if you support trans people, if you talk about racism, if you, you know, have LGBT on your website, if you are researching science, if you're researching the medical impacts of racial disparities in maternal health outcomes, then no federal funding for you. It's like it's just everywhere. It's everywhere. And the reality is that these attacks are resulting in trans people, their families, the people who love them, living in a constant state of fear, looking for exit plans from the United States. And that really is just, it's just really hard to watch. But also, I am more motivated and driven to fight back than ever.
I mean, one of the things I've seen is the thing about passports and gender markers on passports. And there was a trans woman who had applied for her new passport, and she had fully transitioned and had her F on the passport. And then she got her passport, and they said, we corrected it. And turned your F back to an M. And she did a social media video about it, and the ACLU, I think, has taken on the case. But just that idea of, like, and as she says, and I think this is such a complicated issue, but please talk about this, she presents as a woman. So if you're not going to make her go to the men's room, it doesn't make any sense.
First of all, this entire administration's policy is premised on the idea that every aspect of life has to be sorted based on our, you know, cell size at the time of conception. So the idea that if you have a large cell, you produce a large cell at conception, therefore you're a female and you go to the female spaces. And if you have a small cell, you're male. We don't order the world that way. It's not like people are walking around being like, oh yeah, let me go to the small cell bathroom and then, you know, doing genetic testing at the door, because of course nothing is binary in that way, including, you know, the breakdown of any aspect of sex. And the reality is we live and move through the world with a self-determined sense of our sex. That's what happens. There's not guards at the bathroom door. And this, they're trying to enforce this idea that they alone can control what it means to be a man and what it means to be a woman on federal identification, in restroom uses in public buildings, in sports, in healthcare, in how each individual and each individual family understands their bodies. And that is a dangerous thing to cede to the government. And the more we cede that, the more we give them the type of surveillance and control over our bodies that allows them to build the type of government that they want, which is where they are singularly powerful and our rights as individuals are diminished.
I would imagine you're hearing stories from trans folks around the country about how this is impacting their life now. Is there any stories you could share with us that you're hearing about from people around the country?
I mean, I can't even tell you. It's so many stories. And first, as to each of these executive actions with the healthcare, you know, I'm hearing from, what's so heartbreaking is I got so many messages from 18-year-olds who were like, I was waiting until I was a legal adult so I could go out and have control over my body, over my life. And they canceled my doctor's appointment on the way to the doctor because of executive order. Or parents who have, you know, their kid has been so distressed about the onset of puberty and they've only ever been known in the world as a girl but were assigned male at birth, and they were on the way to the doctor to get the care that the parents and the doctors and the young person all agree was essential, and then care is shut down. And families who already relocated from a state where their care was banned moved to another state only now to have the care banned again. Mm. I mean, these stories are just so devastating. And then with identification, I mean, for me, I've had an M on my driver's license, my passport, for a very long time. And the idea of me having to leave the country with a document that classifies me as female. And when you're traveling abroad, you use your passport for everything. You check into a hotel, you turn over your passport. So it would, in essence, announce in every interaction, you know, both with private citizens and with government officials that you're trans, and it brings suspicion, it creates instability. And that's what people are fearful about, is to be forcibly misidentified by the government, and then to have to carry that around, not just domestically, but around the world. And I think people are very, very scared, which is why, you know, we're taking legal action in the context of passports, in the context of healthcare, in the context of schools, because we need people to feel like they can exist in the world safely. And if litigation is one way to show people that we're fighting back, then that is what we're going to continue to do.
Yeah, and we've talked about this a little bit, but I'd love for you to sort of even go a little further about how the Trump administration, some middle-aged comedians have made it seem like trans is separate from all other categories. So you can't be black and trans. Or trans is just trans. It's not poor and trans. It's not rich and trans. Like, you know, in that there's just this category of people called trans who are separate from the rest of us. Can you talk about how those intersections actually do impact the trans people's identity?
Yeah, I mean, I do think there's this way to try to exceptionalize trans existence. And it happens in a number of different ways. It's sort of this idea that transness is so foreign that you can't ground it in anything else that we might consider human. But then, of course, that's so disconnected from reality, where obviously there's unhoused trans people, there's disabled trans people, there's black trans people, there's trans immigrants, and all, you know, there's trans people in all communities. And always, there always have been across, you know, all of history. And there is this effort to sort of cast transness as this new and weird and unsettling thing, but transness has always existed, and simply mocking trans people doesn't make us any less real and make us any less part of all these communities. And at the end of the day, what all of this reflects, from the government policies to comedians fixating on trans people with basic jokes that aren't even funny, is that there's an anxiety about sort of the malleability of the gender binary. The idea that there are, you know, so many ways that we can be, you know, more than just sort of how we think of men and how we think of women. And that causes people a lot of anxiety, because it does remind us that the world is more expansive than we're told. And with that freedom comes a lot of questions for people about, well, what am I supposed to do with all of that possibility? And so I think the reaction is to try to make people smaller. And that happens by suggesting that trans people are so anomalous. But another thing I think is important is that the very same ways that trans people are cast as dangerous or weird or different than other historically oppressed groups, that every iteration of discrimination looks precisely the same way. Gay people, also, we don't want you in our, that, you know, the same stories we're told. We don't want gay people in the locker room because they will sexualize us. We don't want gay people mm-hmm. in the military. We don't want gay people to be teachers. That was Anita Bryan's campaign. And then, you know, we moved on from that, sort of, and put the hatred on trans people. But and then, you know, historical oppression and anti-blackness takes the same form. It's the same story over and over again, suggesting each time that it's new. And it's not. It's never new. It's always the same.
Yes. So obviously I can keep talking about that, but I there's something we have to get to. So you, I mean, let's just take away all the stakes at play, all the things that were going through your mind, or all the gravitas. But in December of 2024, you became the nation's first openly trans person to argue in front of the Supreme Court in U.S. versus Scrimeti. I just want a second. Just the fact that you were arguing in front of the Supreme Court, I know it's hard to separate what you were arguing about, but I would imagine that that was a big day, that there was a lot going on for you that day.
Yeah, definitely.
I mean, I guess I'm trying to say, like, there's the, like, I'm here to present the case, but also, like, yeah. I'm in front of the Supreme Court, you know.
Yeah, it was a big day, and it takes a lot. It takes a lot of preparation. It takes a lot of emotional energy. Obviously, that emotional energy is escalated when it's a huge civil rights case, and it's a civil rights case that implicates your own life. When there's this narrative of his, you know, it's the first of something, which always, you know, in the U.S., people love that. So it creates all of this extra energetic feedback, but in general, it is somewhat surreal as a lawyer to say, okay, I'm walking up to the lectern in the Supreme Court and going to start my legal argument. It is a surreal experience that I certainly will never forget.
Was there any? I mean, I know that we're talking about the case. Was there any sort of pride or joy in that experience as someone who's a lawyer, that, like, that's a thing that's one of those, like, goals that I'm sure many lawyers imagine and have? Was there, did you feel the pride of that moment?
So in the moment, I think I was just very focused. And so I wasn't like, oh, I'm very proud in this moment. It was also a very epic time because it was right between the election and inauguration. And I was very, you know, Wicked had come out the week before, and I was, like, very much like Cynthia Erivo, Elphaba, like, it just sort of like, this is going to drive me. And Cynthia's voice is, you know, it was a little bit of Defying Gravity on repeat and trying to get myself into to the zone. And that was helpful, the sort of, you know, musical fight against authoritarianism in the lead up to inauguration in our Supreme Court case. So that, I think, was where I found the energy in a very dramatic sense. And then afterwards, I think when I was able to actually take a deep breath, I was like, wow, that actually happened. And that, I think, was, you know, there was very little time to feel pride, given that we went right into planning for the Trump presidency and then inauguration, but I did try to sort of sit with it and sort of feel the energy, and I did.
I love the idea of you, like, on with Defying Gravity on repeat with Cynthia Erivo, as you sort of, like, we all have our get hype music, and that's I love that song being the song that's getting you hyped to argue for trans folks in front of the Supreme Court. That's beautiful.
You know, it felt like it really fit. And
yeah,
so
for sure.
That was really grateful for Cynthia and Ariana and that coming out, and John Chewett to come out right before. It felt really good.
I would imagine they'd feel honored to know that that was the song that was going through your ears before you argue for trans rights, before you were defying patriarchy.
Yeah, exactly. We'll do a sort of
a remake, yeah.
You know, a remake of it, yeah.
Cynthia Erivo, I know you pay attention to things. Let's do Defying Patriarchy with Chase here.
Yeah.
So there's a phrase, thank you, Chief Justice, and may it please the court. That is a sort of like, that's like the let's get it phrase, right? Let's kick this off. Let's get it on, as they say in boxing. What goes to your mind right before you say that phrase?
Well, yeah. So one thing is you practice so many times that, and I was, you know, I was talking to myself in the street and, you know, wherever. Mm. I was always practicing my argument, which starts with, you know, Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court. And so one thing is I couldn't stop. I couldn't stop when it was over. I was saying that for a month. It was just in my head. And so that is always one of those things when you finish prepping for a big argument, you sort of can't unwind your brain. Mm-hmm. But in that moment, the other thing is, so in my case, the way it starts is the chief will call the case and then to counsel say, Mr. Strangio or, you know, Miss Prelogger. And the world was all anxious. Like, is the chief going to call you Mr. Strangio? And the Wall Street Journal had done an interview with me and they kept asking me this question. And I was like, well, first of all, I don't know. I can't predict. I mean, I think he will. But so then it took on all of this import. And actually, during the argument, in addition to he did call me Mr. Strangio, as did Justice Barrett and Justice Kavanaugh, I believe, in the course of the argument. And then somehow there was all this media, you know, attacking them for properly calling me Mr., which just felt, you know, it's again going back to this pettiness of somehow people are aggrieved by my being affirmed in any way. So I think it took on all of this significance, which in the moment, to be honest, I wasn't focused on it. He could have called me anything and I wouldn't have registered it because I was focused on getting through that part without screwing it up. And there's this this meme video where there's this little kid and he's carrying a mug towards his mom and he's doing such a good job, but he spills a little and then he spills a little more and he just like freaks out and just throws the whole thing. And I was just kept being like worried that I would just make a little mistake and then just like throw the whole cup in the middle of the argument. And I was like, Chase, just keep your cool. If there's a little mistake, you don't have to give up. You're going to do this. So I was very much trying to just keep myself grounded and answer the questions and be present and be responsive to the justices, because what they always say is, you know, a court argument is a conversation and you want to be conversational. It's obviously a very not like a conversation in other ways, but I was very much focused on that.
What's at stake in this case?
Yeah, so this is a case in which Tennessee had banned the gender-affirming medical care for trans adolescents in Tennessee, and the ACLU and our co-counsel at Lambda Legal had sued, arguing that it violated the equal protection rights of transgender adolescents and the due process rights of their parents. And it went up to the Supreme Court, and the real question before the court is this a form of an equal protection violation when the government differentiates between people who are trans and people who are not trans and withholds medication just because someone is seeking to live inconsistent with their sex, which is what the operative prohibition in the Tennessee case said. And, you know, the government said, no, this isn't discrimination at all. Nobody can transition, basically. And so the question is, of course, most immediately relevant for whether this Tennessee law will stand. But if you look at the world we're in now, this is a constitutional question that has relevance, you know, across all areas of life for trans people. But also it's a real question of do the Reconstruction Amendments still stand? You know, we see the President Trump came in day one, no more birthright citizenship. That is an assault on the 14th Amendment. And ruling against us would be an assault on the 14th Amendment. And during the argument, Justice Jackson posed several questions to Tennessee and to us to sort of suggest that I'm concerned here because the government's arguments seem to be undermining every single thing that we have developed over 150 years of doctrine about equal protection. And that is really what's at stake. Like, are we going to have these constitutional protections or not moving forward?
Yeah, so, and, you know, the case combined with the executive orders, do you feel like the executive orders, that will affect the ruling? Or do you, you know, how, it's just, you know, Trump is sort of doing his own thing and, you know, and has created the justice in his, the Supreme Court in his own image as best he could.
Yeah, I mean, I think Trump wants to believe he's the unitary branch of government, and I think that should be alarming. And the executive orders, you know, don't directly affect the outcome of the case, because the question there was, could a state, you know, permissibly ban this medical care under the Constitution? But it has, the decision will have implications for how we challenge the executive orders. But regardless of what, you know, happens in Scrimeti, the Tennessee government in Scrimeti, in essence, said, leave this to the democratic process. What Trump has come in and done is completely subvert the democratic process and say, you know, Congress be damned, I get to make all the laws and policies. And I think that is something that, regardless of what happens in Scrimeti, is simply not, cannot be squared with the Constitution.
Yeah. And you've talked about this a little bit. Like, how do you, you know, sort of, there's always talk about, you're the first, and America likes to make a big deal about the first. And it's a big deal to be the first, let's be clear about that, especially of something like this. And then there's also the fact that you're not there the first transgender person fighting for parking tickets. You're also fighting for this major thing that you said connects to you, is a referendum on trans rights and freedoms. How did you square that circle in your head?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's sort of two things for me that feel really relevant. And the first is that, you know, I'm sort of standing on the shoulders of all sorts of trans people over time who have made it possible for me to be there. And sort of one of my heroes and icons is Pauli Murray, who is a Black, you know, non-binary or, you know, sort of queer legal titan who was responsible for so much of, Justice Marshall's thinking in Brown v. Board of Education, Justice Ginsburg's thinking in her advocacy. And I think about, well, Pauli was not the first just by virtue of circumstance and the time in which Pauli lived. And so it feels in some way sort of a disservice to the long lineage to focus on one person being the first when it's still connected to such rich history. And so I think about that. And then, you know, sometimes I was doing media and, you know, some of the SCOTUS reporters were like, oh, this is a big one for your first one. And I was like, oh, thanks. You know, and obviously the magnitude of it as the, you know, to the second part of your question about, you know, this is sort of a big case and a big deal. I think the hardest part of that was in the preparation. It's just how grueling it was to be going through it over and over and trying to get to the right answer, but also having to be so immersed in all of the vitriol and all of the absurdity to have to fight over this. And so I think the months leading up to it were in fact really the more challenging. And then in the moment, I was just buoyed by the rally outside, the trans people who were with me, and the fact that we were in this courtroom, you know, sort of as so many other, you know, moments represent as well, where you were never supposed to be there, but you're there, and you're there to speak for your community instead of being spoken about. And I do think that's very powerful.
Yeah, I mean, it's just to be that, to sort of know that you're, and I love the Pauli Murray reference. I finally saw that documentary last year, and just to realize, like you said, there but for history, Pauli Murray would have been that person, but
exactly.
It was just not.
Exactly.
It was not going to happen in that time. If this reality goes forward, if this case doesn't rule in our favor or in the favor of the right side of history, how this affects trans kids?
So first, at the end of the day, trans kids will continue to exist. We'll continue to fight for them. But we can't. We can't live in a country where their health care is made criminal or is categorically banned. And I think what we're seeing now between, you know, the 24 states that ban this care and now the federal government seeking to ban it nationally, are trans kids just really reckoning with whether there's a place for them at all in this country. The level of fear, and I think, unfortunately, people really did think that if they lived in New York or California, that they would be safe, that their healthcare would be safe, that they would not be at risk for being, you know, subjected to discriminatory policies in schools. But what we're seeing now is that, you know, this is a federal government that is seeking to, you know, create these national rules and harm people in, you know, places where the state may well try to protect them, but the federal government is seeking to override that. And that means that trans young people and their parents, their communities, are terrified. And just, I mean, it really just, you know, breaks my heart to see these kids out, you know, really just out in the streets, just being forced to tell the country to pay attention to them, to think about their health care. And obviously the case of the Supreme Court is a big part of that fight. But the fight is playing out every single day.
For sure. Yeah, I think that's the as a dad, I think about my girls and just, you know, is whatever they want to do, whoever they want to be. I feel like my job is just to make sure that the system doesn't, and the system can be a teacher at school, it can be, yeah. Or it can be whatever, that I'm there to sort of stand between them and somebody telling them the wrong thing. And I feel like that's, and to imagine them to be in a position as, like, you know, as a trans kid, like, now you can't even play sports. You know what I mean? Or you can't, you know,
You can't go to the bathroom. I mean, these are fundamental. I mean, how are you going to go to school? How are you going to go to work?
Yeah.
And I do think as parents, like, I want people to just have a little bit of compassion. Like, these are parents who, like all parents or what we would hope, are just trying to protect their kids, do right by their kids. They have, mm-hmm. you know, they have prayed and gone through their own reckoning and come out with the determination with their doctors and with their kids that this is the only right course for the people they know best in the world. And now you have the government coming in and telling them no. I mean, you know, from the very same people, mind you, that I think feel very strongly about their own parental rights.
Yep. Yep. So before I let you go, I just want to get the state of the union, or what are the rights as you see them in this current era of America? What are the LGBTQIA+ rights right now? What, you know, if you're trying to update your passport or your license or social security card, if you're looking for hormones or medical treatment, what are your rights right now in this country?
Your rights, you know, in terms of what the federal government is doing, are significantly constrained, and, you know, and we are fighting back. So for federal identification moving forward, there will not be updates to sex designations. We are, you know, suing over that policy with respect to passports, and hopefully we will prevail. For people under 19, the federal government is endeavoring to create national bans on healthcare by coercing institutions to stop providing care by threatening to withhold their federal funding. So there is a real assault on this medical care. I think importantly, though, state identification is totally separate. Go get your state ID if you live in a state that allows you to do so. Go update your birth certificate in your state. That is not controlled by these executive orders, and those are totally independent. And schools, you know, the administration is trying to punish schools that affirm trans students, and we will, of course, fight back against that. But I think the important thing for everyone, this is scary. But trans people have resisted so much, and I have been privileged to be in the presence of elders, to be mentored by elders who led so many movements. Like Miss Major was part of the Attica prison uprising, and you know, was out in the streets in Stonewall, and you know, her motto is, you know, we're still fucking here. I don't know if I'm allowed to say that, but you know, and we are, and we've lived through many systematic attacks, and so look to the elders and look to the ancestors who have paved a path, and yes, the rights are constrained, but our spirit and our sense of possibility, I think, never will be.
It's great. I hope we can say we are fucking here.
I don't know how it works.
Yeah, me neither. It's free speech, nope. Right? It's a free speech organization.
Yeah, we're good. We're good. That's free speech.
Yeah. Now, I also want to talk about people who are allies and want to be active allies. People who, you know, I think about like federal and state employees. Oh, real quick, there's a note in the chat that I'm following that says, you're good to say fuck, obviously. So,
okay.
So we've been given official ACLU permission.
Okay, well, I would have said it a lot more, but I was trying to be respectful.
All right, it's not a time for respectability. Respectability is past, yeah. So, like, I think about somebody who, if you're a federal employee and you want to be you know, helpful to someone who's in this position, who's coming to you to apply for this or change their gender marker there or whatever? Or you're a high school PE coach or PE teacher and you work at a public school and this kid wants to play sports and they, and you, you know, how do you, what would you recommend to federal employees? What are their rights? If they want to like be a good person, but maybe they also want to try to keep their job, you know, I maybe that's not an, maybe that's an impossible thing to answer.
Well, I mean, I think the overall point is don't comply in advance. A lot of these executive orders haven't actually changed policy, and we're seeing a lot of a compliance in advance. We're seeing, you know, the NCAA rolled over in 2 minutes. That's ridiculous. Yes. There was no basis to do that. And as the NCAA themselves said, there are 510,000 collegiate athletes in the, within the NCAA schools, and there are less than 10 who are transgender. So if we're sitting here, you're going to roll over for that minority group, and when you do not have to yet, I mean, that is just disgraceful. And I do think we just, we want to see people not complying in advance. And of course, we know that there are times when you're under threat that you may not be able to take another course. But there's other ways to be in solidarity with people who are under assault right now. You can be a part of changing the narrative about trans life. We are facing, you know, coming off of an election cycle in which there was $222 million spent in anti-trans advertising. We have to fight back against the narrative as much as we have to fight back against the policies, because what's happening, as we were talking about, is that people think it's okay to suggest that trans people are a threat to others. And once you legitimize that notion, you authorize the government to come in and attack a group of people. And we have to all be participants in disrupting that, just as we do in you know, in all sorts of other ways. If the government or if our rhetoric can cast a group of people as an ideology or something the way that the Trump administration is doing with trans people, then it both legitimizes debate over people's existence and then legitimizes policies seeking to attack and eliminate the group. And that is just simply an unacceptable position.
That's a great reminder. I've seen that sentiment shared before. Don't obey in advance. Don't comply in advance. Just because the president signs a thing, that does not always mean that you have to do what that thing says. So don't obey in advance. Yeah.
I think it's really important.
Yeah. Chase, I would like you to talk to the listener, whoever that is, whoever that person is. Obviously, if they're listening to an ACLU podcast, they are probably a friendly, unless it's part of some court-ordered punishment that you have to listen to the Kamau and the ACLU podcast. But if you could tell a listener to remember one thing from this conversation, what would it be? And if you could have listeners do one thing after this conversation, what would it be?
If I could have listeners remember one thing, I think that one thing is that our power grows when we are in solidarity with each other, and that there is a sense of collective exhaustion, fear, not knowing where to turn. But the single thing we can always do is build power with one another. And so that's my takeaway. And then my action item is go take a risk for somebody else who has less power than you do. Because right now there are, you know, just absolutely devastating attacks on immigrants in this country, on trans people in this country, on Black people in this country. So what are you going to do from your positionality to make someone else's quality of life safer and better? And that's what I'm asking myself every single day.
Nice. I love the Cynthia Erivo Defying Gravity. Is there anything where you get hope or strength from right now that is an unlikely place, or anything that's giving you a little bit of pep in your step when you need some extra step pep?
Yeah, well, I'll always go to Cynthia and Defying Gravity. I mean, it's always going to be art for me. It's always, you know, I think this is, you know, I'm going to turn to art, to, you know, to visual art, to musical theater, to poetry, to creativity as my pathway out of the despair. And I always find it because, you know, art helps transport us into new, you know, terrains of possibility. And that's where I want to be. And so sometimes it's Defying Gravity and sometimes it's, you know, Pauli Murray's poetry. And that's where I find really the source of my sense that we're going to fight our way through this.
Nice. Would you like to do your best rendition of Defying Gravity right now?
Before we leave? I think that that would be a punishment for all listeners. And I, there is a video of me doing it the night before the Supreme Court argument. So someday
I will
release it.
It hasn't been shared.
It's never been shared. The people who are trying to, you know, get me grounded the night before, the video is there.
It should be like if you donate X amount to the ACLU. Or if you engage in X amount of political actions, like if you support the ACLU,
video will be released.
If you do a certain amount of activism for the ACLU, we will release Defying Gravity. Where can people keep up with you and your amazing work?
I mean, right here at the ACLU, or you know, on out in the world. I'm here.
You're not fucking going anywhere. You're here.
Yeah. We're still fucking here, and I'm gonna still be fighting. So
nice. Thank you, Chase. This was a great conversation. I appreciate it. As always, it's an honor to talk to you and an honor to get to know you in a whole new way. My 10-year-old also has a Cynthia Erivo thing, so you are very connected.
Okay,
to my
so 10-year-old. We're
yeah,
kin on
you're
that.
Same, same.
So
same.
Yeah, I'm ready for the Oscar campaign. I'm ready. So
okay, good. I hope you have time to really engage in that. I hope everything goes well
in these other things,
so you can engage in the Oscar campaign. Hey, everybody. Thank you so much for listening this week. And guess what? It's Valentine's Day week when this episode comes out. So please share your Valentine's week message of LGBTQIA+ love and joy or messages of support in our Instagram comments. I'll even respond because I love love. And if you enjoyed listening to this episode of At Liberty, please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts and rate and review the show. It really means a lot to us. Give us 5 stars. We're doing the big work here. We really appreciate the feedback, and we want to hear from all of you. And remember, it's Valentine's Day week, so put love in there. Until next time, I'm your host, W. Kamau Bell. At Liberty is a production of the ACLU. This episode was executive produced by the ACLU's Jessica Herman-Weitz and Gwen Schroeder and Who Knows Best Productions, me, Kelly Rafferty, PhD, and Melissa Hudson-Bell, PhD, and was recorded at the Great Skyline Studios in Oakland, California. What's up, Brian? This show is edited and produced by Erica Ghetto and Mariah Gossett for Good Get. And remember, friends, friends help friends stay in the fight. Join us. Don't comply in advance.